popping off the griddle. Pull up on a kid if you're trying to get belittled. All the mamas love me now, I think I'm being brittle. Flex the rainbow.
Welcome to Plates and Pancakes. We're here with Phil Dean, the head football coach of the number two nationally ranked and defending state champion Drexel Bobcats. Thanks for being on, Phil.
I appreciate you having me. Appreciate the coverage you're providing for local kids. What an awesome deal for you to take time out of your day to, you know, give these kids shout outs and highlight the local programs. It's a pretty awesome thing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate guys like you coming over and making it work. So we'll get into a little bit of your bio. You're from Drexel. You graduated from Drexel. You played football at Drexel. Your wife's from Miami.
Yes, sir.
And you said you had two daughters.
Yep.
They're pretty small, 3 and 7?
Yes, yeah.
Now, that's got to be a little tough during football season.
Yeah. Yeah, it's extremely tough, and it's definitely something I have troubles juggling. You know, that how do you find that balance of being a good dad and being a good father, especially to two young daughters, and being a good coach and a good husband as well.
There's a lot to balance in, at least in the winter months.
Yeah.
So where did you go to college at?
I went to college in two different places, but after playing football at Drexel, I got a scholarship to Avila University in Kansas City to be a running back. So I was a running back at Avila University for a while, and about my junior year, I kind of realized I wasn't going to make it to the NFL, and injuries started piling up. So I decided, you know, to hang the cleats up and finish my teaching degree at the University of Central Missouri.
So you played college ball. How was that? Did you enjoy it? Avila's NAIA?
Yeah, Avila's NAIA. It was an honor to play, because not a lot of people can say they played at the next level. But I wouldn't say I had a good experience necessarily. Coming from Drexel, a small school, where I was kind of the workhorse or the star, I wasn't ready for the college football atmosphere and the politics that come with it. And being, you know, on a team of, instead of 20 guys, 100 guys, and a coaching staff of 2 coaches to 5, 6 coaches. So I was never one to go brag about myself and what I thought I could do. And that hurt me in college because I didn't stand up for myself or play the politics to get in good with the coaches, to buy more playing time. I was too reserved and too, just thought like, if I do well, my talent will show, and right, therefore they'll have to play me. So I spent most of my time just playing scout team running back and just like beating my brains in against the first team defense. You know, the defensive coordinator's losing his mind because I'm breaking tackles or, you know, making the defense look bad. So he's screaming at his guys, and they want to kill me even more, you know.
And lose-lose.
Lose-lose. And then in the off season, my job was to win every race. And it's like, so all off season, I win every race, but it doesn't mean anything during the season. So, I mean, I guess I learned what that's like, so now I can help my players navigate that space a little bit more and maybe find a situation that's a better fit for them or prepare them better. My family didn't have much knowledge of what college football was like when we went through it and how to get recruited and things like that.
And you graduated in 2003.
Yeah.
So back then, the knowledge wasn't quite as there like it is now.
Yeah, yeah. You couldn't just go on the internet, and huddle wasn't a thing. So, like, you know, my family, we just essentially just mailed VHS tape. It was right when that VHS DVD kind of, but we just like mailed VHS tapes to colleges, you know, to get me out there, show my film.
So that's, I mean, that's a pretty unique perspective that people don't understand now. Now you just can email it, attach a file and email it. That, I mean, that took work back then.
Yeah. My, you know, there used to be only one copy of the game film, you right. know?
You had to borrow it.
Yeah, we had to borrow it from Coates, so my dad could cut the clips off of it. You know, when he had two VHS players going, one playing, one recording.
And, I remember those days.
Now you can just, you know, tweet out a clip.
Right.
A lot of our guys get looks now because I'll pull a clip from digital film, you know, and tweet it out on the team account, and a college coach will see it and inquire about, hey, tell me more about this guy.
Things have changed a lot. And not very many years. I mean, 18 years, that's not a ton of time. So what's your coaching experience? How many years have you been coaching?
Let's see. As a head coach, this is my sixth year, but there's some assistant years in there. So 13 total.
And now you coached at Miami.
Yep.
And they were 8-man.
Yes.
Then you went back to Drexel.
Yep.
And started coaching. Then they were 11-man.
Correct. Yep.
So making the transition from 11-man to 8-man, how was that?
So my freshman year at Drexel, in the late 90s, Drexel had numbers problems. So they dipped to 8-man for a little bit. In my freshman year, we were actually coming out of that 8-man cycle, returning back to 11-man football. So my freshman year, we kind of played like a half and half schedule. So as a player, as a freshman, we played some 8-man games. And the rest of my high school career, we played 11-man. Went to college, Avila. Well, after college, I got out. I wanted to play a little semi-pro football. I got hooked up with the West Central Warriors. They were in Butler there. And they were 8-man. Semi-pro 8-man team. So once again, I kind of got back familiarized with the 8-man game. So when the job came open at Miami, who has a proud 8-man tradition of football, I was kind of familiar with the game, having played it as a player and then as a semi-professional player. Of course, stepping onto the coaching side of things is always a little bit different as a player. Mm-hmm. But I had a good level of familiarity with it, and that learning curve wasn't as steep as most that just come with no 8-man experience.
Right. That was, we talked to Drew Smith the other day, and he was kind of talking about it a little bit. He didn't have much when he went to Archie, and he had to reach out for a lot of help,
or
at least you had some stepping into it. So you felt the change was fairly seamless?
Yeah. You know, and kind of like Drew said the other day, first thing he did was ask for help. And in 2009, when I got the head job at Miami, I said, well, of course, I want some help too. So I looked for the best coach at the time, which was Brian Messer in Mound City. He won three state titles at Mound City. And I called him up. I said, look, you don't know me. I'm a brand new coach. But it looks like you do things really well. Like, can I come buy you lunch? And he said, sure. So, you know, I drove up to Mound City and bought him some Subway or whatever up there. And we became fast friends, and he became kind of a mentor. And I picked his brain a lot, especially about the coaching side of 8-man and what kind of led to his success.
Now, when you say Mound City, you're talking Mound City, Missouri.
Missouri. Yep. Almost near the Iowa border.
I just, with our...
Mound City, Kansas.
Yeah, you could very easily be confused, so just clear that up. So, at Drexel, when they went 11-8, the community was probably kind of ready for it. Did you have any opposition of people trying to hold out, or how was that?
So, I was at Miami for 2 years, and I'm from Drexel, and the game plan was always to get back to Drexel. As a student, I really enjoyed my time there, and that was kind of a life goal to get back and, you know, teach kids and be raised the way I was kind of taught, give back to the community that gave to me. So my second year at Miami, we were kind of looking around, and we had had some success. We made the state semifinals twice in a row, but the numbers just weren't there. And it's like, man, we might not even have eight guys. And the job came open at Drexel. So at that time, I went to Miami administration and I said, I'm probably going to be going to Drexel, my hometown, but I would recommend the football program come with and co-op. So at that time, 2010, Miami came over with Drexel, and we were 11-man until my first year as head coach 4 years ago. So our last year of 11-man, Drexel won one game and had 13 kids on the roster.
Yeah, so everybody's kind of realizing this is the direction you have to go if you want to survive.
Yeah, our numbers as a school, not just football, but as a school population continue to shrink and get smaller. Of course, you know, the WEMO itself with Adrian and Archie has a very proud 11-man football tradition. Mm-hmm. At that time, a lot of the WEMO schools, Drexel, Rich Hill, Appleton went a little bit before, Osceola went the first, but there was that struggle in those communities, kind of the weighing of back and forth. Our last year, 11-man, that year we had discussed going ahead and making the switch, but we decided, no, we're going to stay 11. Because there's the stigma that, you know, 8-man football isn't real or legit.
Right.
And 11-man is the traditional right way to do it. And proud communities and schools play 11. So there's a lot of working through those feelings and traditions and histories.
Yeah, I can figure that would be tough.
Yeah.
So as far as athletes go, you grew up around here, I grew up around here. Have kids changed? You hear that a lot. Have they changed from back when we were there? Are they a different kind of kid?
Well, in my opinion, Drexel produces a certain sort of kid. And that kid looks a lot like me, like 5'8", 5'9", 150, 180 pounds. Not strongest, not the biggest, but athletic, maybe fast. I don't know what it is about the water in Drexel, but, you know, we got a factory that makes that kid. So I enjoy that because I think back with the guys I played with, and I think to the guys I coach now, and you see a lot of similar prototypes in mm-hmm. the athletes, and it reminds me a lot. You know, now the way in which you have to coach and approach kids has changed, but maybe become smarter, more efficient, more science-based possibly, and less kind of dipping into military kind of similar trainings or mental toughness testing type things.
Right.
Yeah.
In a small school, I mean, kids are a commodity.
Yes.
And you have to have every kid play that you can. It doesn't seem like the pressure's there that maybe when we were younger, that if you didn't play, it was kind of a stigma to your character.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, so many opportunities abound.
Yeah.
That kids don't feel that.
Yeah.
So what do you do to try to motivate kids to come out and play for you?
I often say, like, football used to be a social currency. Like, you're cool if you played
right.
football. And yeah, you're right, it's not that anymore. The kids that don't play are just as cool as the ones that do, which is maybe a nice thing, society-wise. You know, kids my age could get pretty brutal and pick on the kids that didn't play as much, and kids still pick on each other now still, but it maybe doesn't seem like it's there as much. But to get kids out for football, you know, as a guy that played football myself and as a guy that has probably close to double-digit concussions, I can't half blame a kid for not wanting to play anymore. You know, I had two daughters, but the thought in my head, like, if I had a son, would I let him play? Would I want him to play? You know, if I take one more hit to the side of my head, my lights may not come on again.
Right.
You know, and for what?
Yeah.
You know? So there's that piece of me that if a kid don't want to come out, I get it. But there's also the other piece of me where football's provided me many opportunities in my life. Every job I've ever gotten was because of football. I believe it's built part of my character and helped develop me as a person. And I love it for that aspect. So, you know, I try to let kids know that don't play, you know, that care about them as a person, as a student, you know. Right now I teach weights at Drexel, so I deal with a lot of non-football players there, like kids that maybe only play basketball and things like that, and just show them that I care about them first as a person. And we try and sprinkle football in there occasionally. You know, I let them know that the type of football we do at Drexel isn't what you see on TV, and I'm not going to yell and scream at you and make you run until your eyes bleed or try and make you puke. We try and develop skill and build character and treat guys right. And I hope that sales pitch is enough. And, you know, just keep talking to the kid. And maybe eventually they'll come out. We would always love more numbers, though. I wish every guy would play, but I understand when they don't.
Yeah, and other competition teams, baseball, you know, wrestling for some of them over on the Adrian side, it really starts pulling it at your numbers, and those sports are really important to those kids. So
true.
You would be a secondary sport in some aspects nowadays. In the old days, that's not how it was.
Well, and that is what football is facing. It's becoming an orphan sport, and I think football coaches will have to change their approach to make it more intriguing to those kids that it's not their main sport. They're a baseball player first.
In total opinion of mine, football is the last bastion of high school sports that still holds the recruiting value for colleges. So as a football coach, you have to be able to protect the integrity of your program and what kids you're putting on the field. I mean, volleyball, they have competition teams, softball's all competition, baseball. So as football goes, when football dies, high school sports as a whole may really kind of collapse.
Yeah, you're right. That's a great thought.
Now, Prairie View.
Okay,
They're just across the line.
Yeah.
How do they affect your numbers coming from the Miami side, being you guys co-op?
Well, I know when I was at Miami, kids would freely hop back and forth between the border. You know, schools are kind of in charge of kids coming and going, and Prairie View kind of welcomed kids in. So a kid would get mad at Miami school and hop across the border. Mm-hmm. Drexel's right on the Kansas border as well, so you'll see kids hop over to Lewisburg in our case, because that's part of Drexel is in Lewisburg across straight lines on the railroad. So that hurts, you know. You've been working with a kid for 4 years, and you know, I get it. You know, families make their decisions, but to watch them go to Lewisburg, it.
You're fighting a little bit more unique of a battle than Archie or Osceola, some of the other teams in your conference that don't have that pull or draw.
Yeah, you know, of course, an Adrian could go to Butler or something like that.
Yeah, there's always a possibility. Yeah. It seems like maybe over there on that side it might be a little easier, that you don't actually have to pick your family up and move.
Yes, that does seem to be the case, yeah.
On a daily basis, what do you feel like your biggest obstacle is?
I think fighting myself and my ego. I think I'm very driven, but I have to fight the urge to be driven to feed my ego versus going outside myself and thinking more globally. How many of my actions and motivations are self-motivated versus what's the best intention for others? You're in a weird spot as a coach because you're almost like paid to lead. So your opinion weight is placed on it, and you try and model proper ways of acting and thinking to the guys, and as a team you encounter a tough spot and you try and help them navigate it by, you know, saying what you would do or what you think. But at the end of the day, when you stop and think about it, you're like, how much of that was my ego talking? And I'm always constantly trying to check myself.
That's a pretty good take on that. I haven't had that answer yet. So going into that, when did you realize that this was meant for you, that coaching football was your life?
You know, I don't think video games are all bad. growing up as a kid, played a lot of Madden and NCAA college football, and you know, you get a team and you'd build it up from they call it a cupcake, to playing for national titles. And I always really enjoyed the management side of that and calling plays. And then my parents, I was real small, late bloomer. My parents didn't let me play football till sixth grade, till I was a bit bigger. But when I got in sixth grade, my youth coach, Coach Batchelder, was just an awesome man. Really made me love football, made it a really enjoyable thing. And then when I entered junior high at Drexel, luckily I had the same coach from junior high to high school, but Coach Bolton was another man in my life that was highly influential and made football fun and enjoyable. So I kind of look back at those two men that kind of got that spark going. And I looked up to them and enjoyed their leadership. And it was, you know, someday if I could, I'd like to give that to my players. The hope was always to go to the NFL, but that was probably unrealistic. And then the next hope was to be like a head coach at a D1 program. That's probably unrealistic. So you just kind of keep bringing yourself down to reality and realizing more and more clearly what that probably looks like.
So to tie in with your biggest obstacle, how do you manage your and your team's success and keep egos in check across the board?
Well, we try and be very respectful of the game and of our opponents. And by nature, I always prepare for the worst and hope for the best. So every opponent we play, I don't know, my players will roll their eyes at me, but to us, it's the biggest opponent. But we talk a lot to what a respectful football team and a respectful football player look like and how they behave. We tell all, our guys all the time, like, I don't want to hear you talking. Just go out there and prove it during the play. And if you knock a guy on his butt, pick him back up, you know, and do all your talking on the scoreboard, not on social media. And I hope my guys heed that advice. You never know as a coach what's being said out on the field. And, you know, I know we don't got all angels out there. But we try and make it a central point of our program.
Yeah, and boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys.
Playing football brings out sometimes.
It does. And you need some of that too.
I agree with that.
You need some of that.
You gotta let them go every once in a while. Yeah. Let them do their thing.
Yeah.
What would you consider as your biggest setback or failure?
See, this is the one you asked Drew, and I thought, you know what, I'm gonna think about this. But honestly, it's still a really good question. You don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And I've had some success, but also coaching-wise, I'm pretty young. Before I got the Drexel job, most football jobs I interviewed for, I was by far the youngest candidate. So there's definitely wisdom that and experience that comes with age and being in different situations and seeing different things. And, you know, how do you handle this situation with this player? And you got in your head, you're like, yeah, I'd handle it like this and it'd be good. But then you're in it and you're living it and you're kind of working through it. Just like being a young parent, right? Mm-hmm. Everything you do is a learning experience. And, you know, you raise your second one maybe a little bit better than you raise your first, or at least a little different because you learned some things along the way. But also going back to the ego, like being willing to admit, I don't know, that's a tough one too, because once again, as a coach, you're not really paid to not know.
Right.
You're supposed to know in every situation. Because if you don't know, who knows? Yeah. But that comes up often where it's like, gosh, dang it, I should have reacted this way. Or looking back on a kid you had 2 years, you're like, gosh dang it, I didn't connect with him like I wish I would have, or been the role model that I wish I had.
You kind of have all the answers till you get the test.
Yeah, you know, at Miami, you know, probably one of my biggest regrets as a coach at Miami, we had a quarterback who was a very competitive guy. And I'm a very competitive guy by nature. And I let my competitiveness get a hold of me too much in the ways that I interacted with them. Some guys, you do that and it fuels their fire a little bit. But with him, it rubbed him the wrong way. And it came off as attacking him maybe more than I wished. And that was not my intent with him. I really loved him as a player, wanted the best for him, but I could have been more tactful or realized that the approach I was taking was not the best for that kid. And I've apologized to him since, but it is a regret that I let it go there. And I was the adult and the professional, and he was just the kid.
Right. In talking about failures, setbacks, things like that, you were at Drexel, and then you left for a year.
Yeah.
To take a position non-coaching.
Yeah.
And then came back to football.
Yeah.
So that year that you were off, how do you feel that helped you or hurt you? What was your outlook on life during that year?
My last few years as an assistant at Drexel were tough for me. When your first coaching gig is a head coaching gig at such a young age, like the only other place you can go from there is down, because it's really unrealistic to be such a young coach and be a head coach. So you know, I went from head high school coach to assistant high school coach. And then from there, I went to head junior high coach. And it was like, felt like kind of going down the ladder. And when I got to Drexel, we had an awesome, awesome, awesome head coach, Nate Daneman, mm-hmm. Who unfortunately passed away.
Right. That was about 3 years ago, maybe?
I think it's been more now, you know. But he was an amazing guy to work under. When the time came for him to leave, I was kind of hopeful that I'd be next up. That's not where administration decided to go, and that was a tough pill for me to swallow. And it made for some hard interactions with the next coaching staff. Things I regret to this day, because I was bitter and resentful that I didn't get my shot. So my year away came at kind of a breaking point where I needed that to hit that reset button, that refresh button, because I wasn't going to a good place, and it wasn't healthy for me or the coach I was under or the guys. So it served as a little reprieve, a chance to refresh my mind. But there shortly after that year, the head coach job came open at Drexel again. So if I would have known that, maybe I would have stayed and not jumped to Lewisburg for a year. I've always looked favorably at the Lewisburg School District and always kind of wanted to check it out as a teacher, maybe sometime work my way over there. So I was pretty excited to work for, in my mind, a good district.
Now, you're an art major and you taught art over there.
Yeah.
So, do you think there's hidden messages in Da Vinci's paintings?
Strangely enough, I'm an art major, but I'm dual certified in PE and art. And at this point in my career, I've taught both equally, which is kind of strange. You don't see very many football coaches who are
right brain,
teachers.
Left brain.
Yeah. I think that it helps me, for good or bad, see football differently than a lot of coaches, approach it differently. And that kind of goes back to reading an artwork, trying to find meaning in an artwork. You know, you got to go out into a weird place.
Which he did in some of his paintings.
Yeah.
So you didn't answer the question.
Well,
do you think there's
I'm going to give you the ultimate art teacher answer would be, what meaning do you think they have?
That would be a good one. When they take some of his prints and they put them under different lights and
yeah.
you see the different paints he used, was he trying to say more than what the art actually showed? Maybe. That's a good one. I know his journals he wrote backwards.
Yeah.
Which was unique because he was scared of the Catholic Church and what they might do to him if they found out what some of the things was he was doing.
Well, I think, you know, that's the beauty of art is you can derive a meaning of an artwork, and I can look at the same artwork and get something else out of it. But hopefully both of us are getting something from the artwork.
Appreciating the art as
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that's a good answer. I'll deal with that answer. So what do you think is your best attribute? We talked about some of your failures and stuff like that, but what sets you apart, makes you unique?
I think I have a special place in my brain for looking at systems and understanding systems and locating patterns and trying to find better, more efficient ways to run things, or being able to spot where there's a hiccup or a hitch or something can be improved. So that's a skill you use a lot as a head coach. you're in charge of essentially a system or an organism as the football team. So I'm constantly looking for patterns. What do these things lead to success? Do these things get us closer to our goals? Is there a better approach or a better way for this system?
That's a pretty unique take on that, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed systems and stepping back, and I've always been kind of an observer, unless, believe it or not, I'm not a talker. The quiet guy in the room, though, and just kind of taking things in.
So along with your uniqueness, I heard maybe you could be a spokesman for L.L. Bean. Maybe some of your sideline apparel?
Yeah. To get back to eight-man football. I love eight-man football because it's a smaller community. There's less schools doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So the group of coaches is pretty tight-knit. When we coached 11-man, there's no way you could know every coach, even in just 1A, you know. And you're also, add to the mix, you're playing 2A, 3A schools sometimes. So it's just impossible to know all the coaches. But 8-man's so small, like, we all get in a room and we know each other, uh-huh. You know. And every coach kind of has their stick because, you know, every football coach has their stick, you know. So, yeah, that's kind of my thing. My stick is my duck boots. You do this long enough, you stand on enough sidelines with soggy feet, you get tired of it. And from my time at Miami, Coach Brian Wood, he was the athletic director there but also athletic trainer. He's been without me throughout my whole career. But, I was out there, young coach, rain game, freezing, toes cold, and I look over at him, he's got these duck boots on. I'm like, wait, those look really nice. He's like, yeah, they're lined with wool. They're really warm too. And it's like, what am I doing with my life? Like, you know, the next day I went and ordered some duck boots, you know. So when them sidelines get cold and wet in October, at least my feet are nice and toasty.
It goes back to, you don't know what you don't know until somebody kind of helps you.
Find a better system, right?
Exactly.
Of course, I kind of do it a little differently. He's head to toe in rain gear. I wear the boots with shorts, though, so that makes them more obvious.
Right. Yeah, they stand out a little bit. So after football's over, in the evenings, weekends, off season, what do you like to do to unwind?
Well, this kind of goes back to what we touched on at the beginning of the interview. Man, I try and be a good dad. I'm a terrible dad during football season. My mentor, Brian Messer, we mentioned earlier, he told me, he said, I think I've told other people's kids I love them more than I've told my own kids. And he's kind of at the end of raising his kids, and he's telling me the things he regretted. And that's another reason I left Drexel the first time was, at a small school, you keep adding more and more responsibilities, mm-hmm. which was okay when I didn't have kids. But as I started having kids, it's like it wasn't just coaching football. It was coaching junior high track, high school track, being the sponsor of all these different clubs, being athletic director. And it's like it's just too much. And part of me coming back to Drexel was my wife and I agreed to better manage my time and protect that family time. As Brian Messer told me, like, you personally have to protect it because the school has so many needs. They can't take into account what your family needs because they need you filling all these roles. So you got to be very protective. And we kind of said coming back, like, you're just going to be head football as long as you can. Because I pour my heart and soul into it. I spend way too much time on it, excessive amounts of time, and I'm not home enough. So when I am home, I try my best to unplug from football, stop watching the film, stop drawing things on paper, texting players and coaches, and, like, just be present with my family. So we, you know, we like to take our girls out to breakfast, and then after that, we'll go check out a new playground in like Overland Park or something like that. I just try my best to be a good dad.
Yeah, they're only little once.
Yeah.
So in coaching, what is your biggest fear?
I just really hope that my players, when they're done with me, have a positive experience. And I hope that I built them up and I made them feel good about themselves and added positively to their lives and gave them character and helped them work through situations. I fear that I don't do that. I fear that, you know, just like anybody, certain personalities work best with some personalities and rub others wrong. So, you know, there's guys on the team that I really connect with, and some that there's just kind of that, it's not off or anything, but just not that click, you know. Maybe my assistants click better with that because they got different personalities. Mm-hmm. But, like, they're giving, those players are giving so much of their time, attention, effort. They're putting their bodies on the line for me. Like, I hope it's worth it to them. And I hope when they're done, they can be proud of that and they don't have regrets.
So talking about putting their bodies on the line, small school, small communities, how do you handle injuries?
Well, of course, the big injury right now is Jacob Coffey. He injured his knee for us 2 weeks ago. Regardless of the athlete, with our numbers, any injuries pretty impactful. We don't have a lot of depth. That's why we went to 8-man. And you think, well, one player getting injured only affects that position. But for us, we got to move someone from a different position to that position. So now we got to move another guy from another position to that. And then maybe a guy that wasn't playing before comes in. It's like a three-person effect.
On both sides of the ball.
On both sides of the ball. And that, like in your head, you like plan for it again. But like I said, you don't know till you know. And how... You try and do the little things, give guys other looks in different spots, but you don't have thousands of hours at practice, too, to fully flesh things out. So maybe that backup quarterback's only getting a few snaps here and there. He's not running the offense, really. So you just try and build a next man up mentality. And that's one thing that we're working through with it as a team right now is who's going to fill those voids, who's going to step up to the call. It's an exciting time as a coach. Of course, no injuries, exciting, but it's an exciting time to see guys rise up to the occasion and guys maybe surprise you with their level of play pleasantly. And you kind of learn your team all over again because the personality might change a little bit or the things you do well might change.
And then in a state run like you had last year, a little bit of luck comes in there every once in a while, I would say. You were fairly injury-free last year.
We had a few injuries, kids that got taken out for the year. We were able to absorb those and shuffle some things, but overall we were relatively healthy, and going through that experience kind of made me appreciative of it by our general health remaining pretty well, and by the way the ball bounced a couple mm-hmm. games, and prior to winning a state championship, in my mind, a state team looked a certain way and a state coach knew certain things and acted a certain way. And you do it and you realize like that picture you had in your mind wasn't probably real. And I realized I knew less about winning state than I thought I knew going into it, you know?
So building onto that, what's your vision of success for this team, for your career?
You know, growing up at Drexel in the early 2000s, personal success, you look over at Adrian and a coach like Coach Bruto or Midway, Coach Burchett, and there seemed to be something noble about an individual invested into a community so long to have such a high level of success. There's pieces of me that find that intriguing. And, you know, my grandfather went to Drexel, so just once again, pouring into that community that I feel like I've gotten a lot from. So personally, maybe hanging out and doing that. There's a piece of me that could just get rid of it all tomorrow and go chase something else. I don't know, go be a painter or something. I don't know. I like drawing comics. Go draw some comics, see if I can make money. Hopefully personal success, you know, being a good dad, being a good husband, being a good coach, being a good leader, being a good employee. At my heart, I'm kind of a people pleaser, so making people happy. For our team, you know, individual players have their individual goals. I hope they can reach those this year. And then as a team, we have our team goals, and I hope that I can help our guys achieve those and maybe more.
So part of a successful team is the strength and conditioning program. I enjoy that aspect of it. I mean, we're sitting in a gym.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on strength and conditioning? How do you go about it?
Well, you and Drew kind of mentioned it, Drexel, and because I'm the only strength coach, I'm in charge of not just football, but all strength and conditioning. Drexel Athletics is a fast cap program. It's a sprint based program. So we're big on building speed, obviously, but power is big as well. In a traditional sense, we maybe focus less on strength, where your traditional weight program is built primarily on strength and maybe less on building speed. You know, power's always kind of been that middle ground, you'll say. So we kind of flipped the paradigm on its head. We have a four-day school week at Drexel. So I see the kids 4 days for weights, and two of those days we're on the track.
And that's what I was getting ready to ask.
Only two of them are we in the weight room.
I didn't want to get too far off into maybe some stuff people don't care about, but I enjoy talking sprinting.
Yeah.
So you're 2 days on the track.
Yeah.
Are they broke up into acceleration, top speed? Are they that way you're not? What people don't take into account, I don't think, is the volume that a runner can get in a very short amount of time.
Yes.
If you figure on the average, a stride's 500 pounds of force coming into the ground, it takes very little 40s to be at a high accumulation of
correct
weight. You wouldn't work your squatters the way some sprinters get worked.
Exactly, yes.
So by breaking that up, do you find that that helps your athletes recover a little better and faster?
You are a feed the cats guy.
To a certain extent,
yes.
I'm very big on West Side, which they do the dynamic work, and then Louis Simmons' approach on sprinting, I really like.
Yeah.
Now, we do employ a lot of max effort.
Yes.
But I get the feed the cats mentality. I think it's great.
We are very low dose because we err towards keeping our athletes fresh.
Right.
Because a fresh athlete is a happy athlete, is a bouncy, springy athlete, is a fast, fresh is fast. Fresh is healthy. The more stress accumulation you have increases your chances of injury. So we always try and do too little, the minimal effective dose.
Climbing the ladder.
What is the least amount of work we can do to get the most effect out of it? And always leave with gas in the tank. Never let today ruin tomorrow. That's not always been my approach. I used to pride myself as a football coach of building mentally tough players and conditioning them until they threw up and running ladders and suicides for an untied shoe and things like that. But I found myself in games where my players didn't have the juice.
You're looking,
they're over-conditioned. I let Wednesday practice ruin Friday's game, which is probably the most important thing. We ran so many suicides and ladders on Wednesday. There is physically impossible, even as teenagers, for them to be recovered to a level they needed to be successful at a football game. So as a coach, you're in the pregame and you're like, guys, you just look dead. Why don't you have any energy? It's easy to make kids tired. That's right. Easy. Any idiot could do it. Uh-huh. You get out there and just make them run, you know. The tough thing is to make them fast.
Right.
Yes.
Because there is a such thing as a speed barrier.
Yeah.
And you can only run them so hard before you meet the speed barrier and actually reduce.
Yes.
I don't know, you know, without there again, without getting too far into this, if you have 100 meter sprinter, that last 5%, he's in deacceleration.
Yes.
Anything you train over that, you've taught the kid to be slower.
Yes. Yeah. You're a feed the cats guy through and through.
I haven't read enough.
The words that are coming out of your mouth are...
Maybe feed the cats came from Louis Simmons' theories.
I think there's a little crossover there, yes.
So I'm glad that I'm able to talk it with you and actually kind of be on the same level of what you're thinking.
Yep. We work acceleration one day. So our acceleration work is our 40s. And then our other day, we work max speed, which is a flying 10 yards. So on the 40s, you're at a dead stop.
Right.
So you have to accelerate to pick up speed. Mm-hmm. On the flying 10, you get that rolling start. So you do still accelerate there.
But not
but
the same.
The emphasis is on reaching a top speed because you get the running start. Typically, for me, my kids will run 2 at minimum.
Okay.
Each day, 2 40s or 2 10s. Some of my, you know, as they build up the ability to sprint more often, some people would call that conditioning. Feed the Cats calls that sprint reserve, the ability to repeatedly sprint at a high level. Time after time, then athletes may run 3 to 4 of them in a given setting.
That's kind of what I had figured in the math in my head, somewhere between 2 and 6.
Yeah.
Depending on where your athlete is and where you're peaking,
yeah,
where it is in the week, how far you are out of season.
You know, me personally, I don't have competitions. I play on Friday, but I like to run them too. Mm-hmm. And that's why I work personally about 6. But, you know, you know what your best is, so when you run them, you can kind of look at your time on the next one, and you can kind of start to see that decline coming.
Yes.
And it's roughly 20% of your max. You go, all right, we need to stop.
Yeah, because it's 6 sprints, you're pushing 5,000 pounds worth of total work, roughly. So you could build them up very quick and have a lot of volume.
Of course, you want a ton of rest in between.
Yeah, because you're working on the 3 tanks of of your body. So you have your maximal power, then you have more aerobic.
Yes.
Yep. And then you get into endurance. Yes. You're trying not to let your athletes get into the aerobic phase and stay anaerobic.
Yeah, yeah. You know, throughout the football season, we may dip into traditional conditioning. But like last season, we only did that 2-3 times.
I have yet to see conditioning beat strength. It seems like it takes all the conditioned kids' conditioning to keep up with the strength of the really strong kids?
Well, your classic question with the Feed the Cats program is, how do you build mental toughness then? As a program, we practice performance. We don't just run to run.
When we mean something.
When we run, we're strapped up. We're timed up.
Yeah, you got PRs on the line.
You got to perform, you know. And you ask me, that is mentally tough. You try and run a 40 at PR speeds when you're not feeling good. You're feeling sick or you're a little banged up from Friday night and you're coming back from working back through that kind of rehab of like a tweaked ankle. That's, to me, that's mentally tough just as much as running suicides till you want to give up.
And then you hate it. The mental side, yeah, you might be mentally tough, but at the end of the day, you hate it. Where maybe your system, you don't hate it. You're looking forward to, hey, I might be able to break my PR today.
That's a hope. The hope that it's better for the kids because it's more enjoyable, less stress on their bodies, keeps them healthy. Also, though, with conditioning, who always wins? It's the most in shape guys. Okay, I was always that guy. I always won the suicides. How hard did I really go? Well, you looked at me and I was, you know.
Right, you can make it look like something.
But really, I was probably going like 70%. Okay, who always loses? Well, it's the big guy down at the end. Well, how hard is he going probably? He's probably going 100.
Yeah.
You know.
That's a good point.
So are we getting what we want out of that? I don't know. You know, and that's the beautiful thing about the game of football, though. Like, just as much as I'm minimal effective dose, there's other coaches that have been highly successful kind of with the traditional style of football. And we're all just trying to find what works best for us and what we understand and what we can teach and coach. So that's the beautiful thing about football.
So how do you evaluate what's working? And then we'll, after that, we'll move on to some other questions. But how do you evaluate what you're doing is working?
As far as like sprint-based stuff?
Yeah. Do you take your metrics at the beginning of the season, end of the season? Do you just kind of work through it and watch your game film and try to see what's happening? How do you do that?
Yeah. So once a week we're measuring 40s, and then the other time we're measuring flying 10s. So we got this large database of our athletes and what they run week by week, and we can compare it back to previous years. So like right now, I'll have a kid step up to run a 40. I can tell them their best 40 ever, but I can also tell them their average from last year, and I can also tell them, hey, last week you ran this. So we have these markers we try and fit in, you know. And if I have an athlete that PRs in the 40 or flying 10, a football athlete in week nine of the season, like he's got to be feeling good. He's got to be feeling fresh. Even the toll of the football season takes that beating on his body. He can still perform in that metric. You know, and it's more anecdotally, but as a coach, you're always trying to look for it, like you said, in game film. Do I feel like we have those speed bursts and those athletic qualities show up during the game? And, you know, you see them, but you might be looking for them a little bit more just to justify what you're doing.
And then if a kid hits a speed barrier, you have the training log back on his weights that you can adjust, pull, add, I would imagine, with all that work.
Yep.
So to move on, because I know not everybody's interested in stuff like we are, what is something holding you back from being the coach you could be?
Well, you know, we've talked about kind of that knowledge base. I think time is another one in time management. I feel like to do it the right way, I gotta probably spend more time on it than I should. I could be more efficient in that area because I'm the type, if you let me work on a project, I'll work on it you know, I won't get sleep. I'll work on it till it's finished. So a lot of times I feel like I run out of time, but I could probably manage it a bit better and understand what things I'm doing is actually, you know, what is it? Pernille's principle, 20% of the things you do give you 80% of your results.
Right.
So I probably need to examine that a little bit stronger and realize what I'm actually doing and what is just kind of busy work or what I'm doing to try and calm my nerves and feel like I'm actually working towards something.
So what inspires you to go as hard as you go? What is it in the back of your mind that drives you?
You know, growing up, my parents really didn't have like a set of rules or expectations. The only thing they told me is like, we don't care. We just want you to do your best. And that, I think that could apply to everything in life. But that's always stuck with me. Like anything I do, coaching a football team, cleaning a toilet, I'm going to try and do my best. And it's going to be the best looking toilet you ever seen, or hopefully the best football team you ever seen. But I take a lot of personal pride in a job well done.
Well, I appreciate you coming over. You came over after practice. It's a late night. Not a lot of people would do that. I think your football guys are lucky to have a guy that would come over here and talk about his team, talk about them. So anytime, I'd be more than happy to talk to you again. Any of your players ever want to come over for a morning podcast, they're more than welcome. But thank you, and have a great rest of the season.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. This is an awesome thing you're doing for the Adrian community and extending out to other communities. Growing up in Drexel, you know, playing Adrian, there's always that rivalry, if you will, competitiveness anyways. But always looked at Adrian as a quality place. My senior year was the year Adrian won state in football. What a cool event for WEMO football. You know, right now, Adrian's cooking, Butler's cooking, you know, Windsor's down a little bit. Drexel and Archie are having success. Just like, it is so awesome in my mind that Southern football in this specific area is just kicking tail.
Yeah, they're playing, all of them are playing really
what a
well.
Great time.
Well, we're not beating up on each other like we used yeah. to, so everybody's getting a chance to compete and win.
But it's awesome that you're doing this for the guys, and we appreciate the coverage for Drexel football as well.
Well, thank you. Anything we can do to help, it's pretty enjoyable, and I hope the kids get a lot out of it. I know having you and Coach Drew come, that just helps.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate your time, and thank you again.
Thank you. Take a L, no more.